I'll call this meeting to order. We have minutes. Representative Hilty, if you would move the minutes for February 28, 2005. Thank you. Any discussion?
The motion would be dissent.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. 1-0.
Good.
We are going to, members, move House File 1043 to the top of our agenda because Representative Emmer has three testifiers, and they are all going to keep their testimony extremely short, and we think this may be an easy bill. So, Representative Emmer, if you would like to move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would formally move House File 1043 to the General Register.
All right. And Representative Emmer, you have is this your amendment? Your delete all?
Yes, it is.
All right. And Representative Emmer moves the AO50115 amendment to put the bill into the form that he would like. Any discussion on that? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief. This is a non-controversial bill. It's simply a recodification of the Business Corporations Act. And the folks that are here to testify today will give you a little history. Essentially, this is a five-year work in progress sponsored by not only the Minnesota State Bar Association but other interested parties. If you've taken the time to read the bill, it's basically realigning certain elements that were out of the appropriate chapter into the correct chapter. There's nothing new as far as has been explained to me. It's being added. The amendment simply is the same thing with respect to insurance corporations. The insurance corporations law is being moved into Chapter 66A with the other insurance language. And with that, I'm not sure who's going to go first. Steve Johnson is going to be the first witness.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Steve Johnson. I'm a partner in the law firm of Lindquist & Venom and served on a committee with the Hennepin County Bar Association to review and address the problem of Chapter 300. I'll be very brief. 100 years ago, all the corporations in the state of Minnesota were governed by Chapter 300. And then we had Chapter 301. Chapter 302A came in about 15 years ago. But banks, insurance companies, and public utilities were accepted out through that process and remained subject to Chapter 300. So we have a very antiquated corporations bill that governs not the business operations of banks, but the corporate, the articles of incorporation, bylaws, meetings, and things like that, plus a hodgepodge of statutes that have ended up in the banking statute itself. What we did not make any substantive changes to the law. We essentially looked at Chapter 302A, we looked at Chapter 300, went through a laborious process of noting the differences or noting where the counterparts were as much as possible. We essentially adopted Chapter 302A so that the general corporate code, where most people and most practitioners are used to looking for corporate issues, will now govern banks in their internal operations. And where it was appropriate, where we had industry-specific things, sort of unique to the banking operation, we put those into the banking statute. So chapters 46, 47, 48, 49 now house those, which is where you would expect to look for banking-related legislation. National banks for the last 20 years have had the right to elect to be governed by Minnesota statutes, Chapter 302A. And so all we've done is essentially level the playing field a little bit, make things hopefully a little simpler for practitioners and citizens alike. That's it. My colleague.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, now I have Michael Rothman from the Winthrop & Weinstein law firm. He's going to talk about the amendment that's been added.
All right. Mr. Rothman, if you could introduce yourself and give us your brief testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Rothman from Winthrop & Weinstein. The amendment addresses insurance and insurance stock and mutual insurance companies. In essence, it does a few things. It creates a statutory home for mutual insurance companies, for all mutual insurance companies, utilizes the foundation, as a foundation, Chapter 66A, which was the chapter where property and casualty mutual insurance companies found their home. It retains and moves key Chapter 300 provisions to 60A07 or to 66A, wherever they were appropriate. Consolidates some of the mutual insurance company statutes that were found throughout the insurance code and puts them into 66A. And it adopts Chapter 302A for mutual insurance companies with certain exclusions and some modifications to make it appropriate, make the law appropriate to the governance structure of mutual insurance companies.
Thank you, Mr. Rothman. Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, I believe as the committee can gather from the testimony and from the bill before it, this is a technical bill, purely streamlining the process and hopefully putting the pieces in their proper place within the statutes. With that, I would renew my motion.
All right. I do have a question for Mr. Rothman or Mr. Johnson. How long has the bar been working on this particular bill?
About 5 years.
Thank you. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For both of the testifiers, are there any substantive changes at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I can speak to the mutual insurance companies. Most of the changes are simply taking a statutory provision and moving it to another place in the statutes. For mutual insurance companies, the corporation's law doesn't work. Corporate law doesn't work because mutual insurance companies don't have shareholders, stockholders. The policyholders are the owners of the company. So, in a sense, substantively, we've had to retool the corporation's code so that it could apply to mutual insurance companies. And in doing that, there are provisions in 302A that do not make any sense to apply to mutual insurance companies because of the non-shareholder status of those corporations. And then it made certain modifications so that it made more sense. But all within the framework of keeping the current status quo, basically, of how mutual insurance companies are governed, as well as regulated by the Department of Commerce in the state of Minnesota.
Simon? Other questions? Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if this question needs to be answered elsewhere, that's fine, but I thought I'd ask it now. As I look through the amendment, I see definitions, domestic insurance, and then there's a mutual insurance definition, and then there's a domestic mutual insurance definition. I'm just wondering how all those different definitions actually work together.
Mr. Rothman?
A particular spot.
Section, let's see, Mr. Chair, page 1, line 13, it talks about domestic insurance corporations. And then within the same section but a different subdivision, and maybe if it would make more sense if I had more time to read it.
No, that's fine.
Page 2, section 23, it talks about domestic insurance corporations again, and then it moves to... I'm trying to find where I saw all these definitions. Page 3, section 5, it talks about incorporation of just plain insurance corporations. Then it moves in section 8 to domestic mutual insurance companies on line 33.
I'm sorry, that was...
I guess, wondering if each section is just dealing with a different type of corporate structure, a different...
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Mr. Rothman?
In the Minnesota Insurance Statute, 60A, there's a lot of definitions of insurance companies, and you can trace those back, and they're defined for you. a domestic insurance company or corporation is an insurance company that is domiciled in the state of Minnesota versus foreign, which is outside. And that would be for the first two that you pointed to. If you look on page 3, line 33, if the reference there is to a domestic stock corporation. And the distinction there is between corporations, insurance companies that have been established on a stock plan with shareholders versus a mutual plan. And they're two different governance mechanisms. Let me find...
Mr. Chair, that's fine. I guess I will just take the time to read the amendment a little bit more thoroughly so I can understand the different definitions. Right. That's fine. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Other discussion? Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, are we going to have further testimony on this bill?
Well, let me ask, are there others in the audience who would like to testify either for or against this bill? I don't see any representatives.
Well, to that point, Mr. Chair, I was wondering, I see that Mr. Black from the Secretary of State's office is here, and I was just wondering if being that he's one of probably the state leading experts in corporate law, the Secretary of State's office and his division actually looked at this bill, but I do have a question for the author or from the other testifiers, which is there anything in this bill or the amendment that actually changes what's currently possible under current law? And if so, what is it?
Mr. Black, would you introduce yourself? And if you can answer the question, that's great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Bert Black, business and legal analyst with the Office of the Secretary of State. Let me just address the first part of your question, which was, were we involved? And the answer is yes. I think it was described as, the effort was described as laborious, and I can testify that it was so. We've been doing this for about 5.5 years with a varying cast of characters and participants from the various industries involved. But it's been quite a detailed look through each of the statutes. And I can tell you that, at least to my understanding and knowledge, that we are looking here at something which the approach was very conservative with a small c in the sense of looking at Chapter 300, comparing the provision in Chapter 300 to Chapter 302A, the goal was to see if we can update and unify the knowledge of Minnesota lawyers and Minnesota citizens as to what law governs. And the more laws you have that govern, and the more you divide it up, the more complicated it gets. Our goal has been to see how much of 302A we could apply, where 302A was either inapplicable or did not make the policy sense with respect to banking and insurance, because those are highly regulated industries. Then we preserved the original provision and moved it to the substantive chapters, with the exception that Mr. Rothman indicated for mutual insurance companies, because those are a different animal. And I can tell you that our approach to the mutuals was very detailed and very intense, and a lot of hours by a lot of people at both the attorneys and people in the industry have been put in. So I guess the short answer to your question is, as far as I can tell, we're not allowing banks or insurance companies to do anything more or different than they could have done, than they can do today. But we are trying to update the law from a law which was originally, actually, it's more than 100 years. I think it's back in the 19th century that the original language in Chapter 300 was actually passed. And we're trying to get that to a little closer to the 21st century.
Thank you, Mr. Black.
Thank you.
Other discussion?
Mr. Chair, just briefly, I do have a question. It's difficult. I think that our members here are trying to figure out is when we have, I think it's a 25-page bill and a how many page amendment with a lot of language changes. If there aren't any, my theory on that, if there aren't any surprises in here, and that's what we're hoping there aren't. I just had one question on page 10, lines 31 through 34 and 5 through 8. It states that any action which might be taken at a meeting of the board of directors may be taken without a meeting if done in writing signed by all the directors. And would this language allow the board to circumvent meetings of shareholders, including annual meetings, so as to potentially evade any input from shareholders or decisions regarding the company bylaws, for instance? It kind of reminds me of your meeting by teleconference. Thought there, but in this case, they're meeting by writing, and when you meet by writing, nobody's watching.
Representative Emmer, are you trying to trick us?
No. Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawik, I'll tell you, when I was asked to carry this bill, I read it in detail, and I think the folks that brought it to me would confirm for you that I gave them more questions than they expected. And that one in particular sounds like one of several that I asked having to do with certain ability of corporations to insulate their board of directors. And in each instance, I have been assured, and I understand, it's already in the law. All they're doing is, this is a technical bill in terms of reorganizing the statutes so that they are easier for the public and the practitioners to use. And I'll just add that the same legislation has already passed through the Senate, and I believe is on the way to the floor.
Right. Mr. Chair, well, maybe it's just because they've been working on it for 5 years and a freshman was carrying it that I was just wondered. But I am glad to hear that you have read it thoroughly and that that is the case.
Representative Amor?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
thank
you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just make a comment to that. I think oftentimes we underestimate the term freshman around here, and I think as people come into the legislature, they bring with them a whole host of experiences with them, and Representative Emmer clearly brings with him a number of experiences and expertise as well.
This is almost too much to handle. Unless there are other questions, I'd renew the motion that I tried to prematurely renew earlier.
All right. Any further discussion? Representative Emmer renews his motion that House File 1043 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I'd move to reconsider House File 680.
Representative Westrom moves to reconsider House File 680, which is Representative De La Forest's bill that did not pass on a tie vote on Monday. I believe it's in the back, is in the back of our packets. Any discussion on that motion? Representative Hilke.
No, Mr. Chair, I don't recall all of the rules of procedure, but don't you have to have been a party to the original action in order to make such a motion?
Thank you. Representative Hilke, because I knew this was going to happen, I checked in the rules, and Rule 6.21, which is on page 26 of the rule book, says a committee may reconsider an action while the matter remains in the possession of the committee. A committee member need not have voted with the prevailing side to move to reconsider the action, and there's no further language in there regarding it. So my interpretation of that would be that any member could move to reconsider. Any further discussion on reconsideration?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, we were talking, was it who moved the reconsideration?
Representative
I did.
Westrom.
Okay. Because on the House floor, it has to be somebody on the...
Committee rules are different, Mr. Chair.
That's correct. Any further discussion? All right. All those in favor of reconsidering House File 680, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. We have House File 680 in front of us again, and Representative De La Forest would then move that House File 680 be recommended to pass and sent to the Commerce Committee. Did you have anything you wanted to add at this point, Representative De La Forest?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ellison?
Mr. Chair, I guess my question is, we had a vote, and everybody was out here to vote, or had an opportunity to be. Is there some new fact that has come to light to cause people to change their minds? If there is, I'd certainly love to know it. Or was there some memo passed out that gives us some new information?
Representative Ellison, none that I know of. I haven't seen a memo. Representative Westrom?
Well, Mr. Chair, just quickly, Mr. Representative Ellison, I had a bill up in another committee, and this bill came and went before I was able to make it back, and I'm a co-author on the bill. and would have liked to have been here to vote the first time, but schedules sometimes create those conflicts.
Representative Hilke. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could ask Representative Westrom, are you planning on hearing this bill on the Regulated Industries Committee?
Representative Westrom.
At this point in time, I don't think so, but I'd have to review this with Brian and if there's a reason to, but I think most of it's basically statutory laws that deal with landlord-tenant law instead of electricity. But
well, Mr. Chair and Representative Westrom, I realize that you were not here for that testimony on this bill in this committee, but one of the testifiers was a representative from Xcel Energy that I think made pretty clear that this does have, that this is a bill that has implications for utilities and for utility regulation as well as the considerations that you mentioned.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, if there's a need for it, it'll come to our committee. I'm not opposed to it coming there if we need to. We'll look at it closer, and if different members, sectors feel compelled that it really has to come there and we decide that, I'm willing to bring it there. But at first glance, when I looked at the bill, I didn't think it needed to come to our committee, but that's part of the process. Luke calls bills in once in a while that are traveling, and we'd be willing to do it in this one as well if we feel it needs to come.
Well, Mr. Chair, not to belabor the point, but one of the matters that was brought out in the testimony on this bill is that there is, in fact, an open docket before the PUC dealing with this matter, and I think there's some jurisdictional questions here that certainly need to be resolved, and I would think Representative Westrom that would best be resolved in the Regulated Industries Committee.
We'll keep that in mind, Representative Hilty. I'm not saying it won't come there either, so it's got to pass out of here first. That's what I understand.
Now, I'm simply going to note, Mr. Chairman, that if I'm not mistaken, the motion before us is simply to reconsider, and certainly matters of committee jurisdiction will be worked out, and I'm sure Representative Westrom will request the bill and take it if that's where it needs to go.
And just to clarify, we have voted to reconsider, but the bill is actually in front of us to be sent to Commerce Committee right now. Representative Ellison.
I request a roll call.
All right, roll call has been requested. Any further discussion? Seeing none, the committee legislative assistant will take the roll on the bill. And the motion is by Representative De La Forest to recommend that House File 680 be recommended to pass and sent to the Commerce Committee.
Representative Frost. Aye. Representative Dean.
Aye.
Representative Ellison.
Nay.
Representative Emmer.
Yes.
Representative Hilty.
No.
Representative Lesh. Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Slawick.
No.
Representative Westrom.
Yes.
Representative De La Forest.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes. The motion prevails on a vote of 7-4.
Mr. Speaker.
Representative Simon.
Pardon, Mr. Chair, excuse me. Just for the record, so we understand, Representative Lesh is not here, but just so we have a clean record, he had yesterday or previously indicated that he was refusing himself. So
yes,
that's the reason, not his absence, that he didn't vote.
Right. Okay. The first bill on our agenda is House File 118, Representative Erdahl's bill. I had laid that on the table on Monday. I will take that off the table for a further discussion on the bill. Representative Erdahl, if you'd come back up, and I believe we already heard from your testifier, Mr. Price, but it appears he's back today to answer questions if they arise. Did you have any other testifiers in favor of your bill? that you feel necessary to call
if
forward?
If needed.
Okay.
I do that. Yeah, solid.
Okay. If the page could... I have listed Mr. Carlson as desiring to testify on the bill as well. So, Joel, if you want to come forward now, and then I believe there are some amendments in our packet as well. I think we started that. Why don't we let Mr. Carlson give his testimony, and then we can open up the questions for any of the testifiers. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association. And just so that the members know up front, both in its previous stop in the Agriculture Committee and now here, the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association is not here to defend claims against fast food companies for weight gain. That is not our purpose of our testimony today. We're here to talk about immunity, and we're here to talk about obesity and the underlying premise of this legislation. We routinely get requests to grant immunity to different groups or entities for various issues, and we try to apply the same standard to each immunity bill that comes before you. And first we try to look at what the public policy is that you're trying to address, and what the public benefit would be if you grant special protection to a different group or entity that is seeking the immunity. And the legislation that's before you right now, we think, falls short in several areas if you apply our general test of grants of immunity to individuals. First of all, this is the first time that I'm aware of, Mr. Chairman and members, in some 20-plus years at the Capitol, where the legislature would be granting immunity to private profit-making ventures for their essentially negligent conduct. If they're not negligent, they don't have liability to begin with. So this is the first time that the legislature would be granting the protection of governmental immunity to private for-profit companies. Immunity in the past has always been limited to nonprofits, to the to governmental entities, or to volunteers, or to people who are donating their trade or service in the public betterment. This is the first time that immunity is being extended to private for-profit companies, and it is based on what we believe is a perception of a problem, and what we really have is a significant problem over obesity. I'd like to point out to the members, as others have indicated, no claim has ever been filed in Minnesota relative to weight gain. We have not had a single case since the first case was filed in 2001, nor do we believe that they are viable. Minnesota recognizes a doctrine of assumption of risk, and we certainly believe that someone who consumes a diet that causes weight gain shares that risk and burden. So we think that we are not seeing claims such as this in Minnesota because we already acknowledge personal responsibility in our state. But what the bill ignores is that obesity is the second leading cause of death in this country, killing over 400,000 people every year. And I've passed out to the committee a press release from Tommy Thompson, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, citing the significant problem of obesity. And in the last decade, deaths due to poor health have increased 33% in this country just in the last decade, and it is on the verge of surpassing tobacco use as the single leading cause of death in our country. It costs all of us, companies and others, it costs all of us, according to our Secretary of Health and Human Services, $117 billion a year. That's the size of the problem that we're talking about. And the bill, as we see it, does not address in any way that public health problem, but ties into a perception about litigation that we believe is unfounded, not only just in Minnesota, but in other jurisdictions as well. I also handed out to the committee a liability ranking that was put out by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that shows Minnesota with the eighth most favorable climate for business litigants in the country. We do not have an overly litigious state, and we do not have a problem with frivolous litigation in Minnesota. And I'm not speaking for other jurisdictions, but I can tell you that we strongly reject the notion that frivolous litigation in Minnesota is prevalent, and certainly that it's not prevalent at all relative to the contents of House File 118. And Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I would there are several amendments at the committee that I've discussed with Representative Erdahl. We understand the problem that they're trying to address, but this bill does nothing for consumers and the problem of obesity. And if we're going to grant the protections of this bill, blanket immunity to growers, sellers, and manufacturers of the foods we eat, then maybe there should be some obligations on their part to either have labeling requirements or other requirements so that consumers can make choices about the foods that they eat. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions about this bill. We do have some concerns about not just the slippery slope, but just granting this blanket immunity protection to a wide industry without a showing of a clear problem that needs to be addressed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Just to clarify, the motion before us was mine from Monday, and that was that House File 118 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register, and we had adopted an author's amendment, the 118A1 amendment. So that is what is before us right now. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Carlson, my question for you is this: is the judiciary inadequate to handle cases like this? For example, I mean, if some citizen feels that they are aggrieved or injured by any number of industries, let's say the lead paint industry, the asbestos industry, let's just say flammable pajamas industry, I don't know, Ford Pintos industry, whatever industry, if they're injured and aggrieved by a product put out on the market, is the judiciary unable to efficiently dispense with cases where cases where maybe their case has no merit, or maybe the case does have merit? Is our present condition of the judiciary unable and incapable of handling cases like this?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ellison, not only do we think it's capable of handling it, we think it's the foundation of our democracy. You know, the first petition in our plank to the king was taxation without representation, but the second plank in our petition was our right to trial by jury. We believe, contrary to what Mr. Price said, we think that juries and lay people have the ability to make decisions about not just elections, but about our everyday lives. And we think that it's an appropriate place. And we have seen, not only have we seen no particular problem in Minnesota with our courts being able to handle this, that study I gave you from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce shows that business thinks we don't have a problem in Minnesota. We get high marks for jury competence, judge competence, handling of evidence, all of those issues that were litigation issues for business. Minnesota exceeds in the country. So we think that our courts are in good shape, and that's not to say that there aren't some cases that you may hear about that make you scratch your head and wonder what is going on there, but our courts have the ability to handle those both with sanctions and with other procedures through discovery and other means.
I was just going to say, I mean, in our rules of civil procedure, don't we have things like Rule 12b-6 to get out lawsuits without any basis or any cognizable legal interest, or Rule 56 to get rid of cases that don't have any factual support, or Rule 11 for lawyers who bring cases who that are frivolous? I mean, don't we have specific measures in law now to get rid of cases that should not be there?
Mr. Chairman and members, we believe that's the case, and not only can I tell you that we believe that's the case, the Minnesota trial lawyers have been here supporting. Federal Rule 11 is codified in law at our insistence and request several years ago in 1997, 549.21. So not only is it a rule, it's a statutory requirement in Minnesota.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could I have Mr. Price respond to that question as well?
Actually, why don't you move up to the table as well? All three of you could sit up there.
Thank you.
Mr. Price, if you could reintroduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, I've been reinventing myself for about 33 years, so I'd be happy. My name is Joe Price. I'm a partner at the law firm of Fabian Benson in Minneapolis. Representative Ellison is correct in the absolute sense that the court system is able to handle a case or several cases or even a few cases. But what we're talking about here is a promise of the plaintiff's bar to turn this into the next mass tort. And our court systems really aren't that well adapted to handling hundreds of thousands of cases. I mean, the best example of that is the asbestos litigation. The asbestos litigation is an embarrassment to this country. It's been going on for I don't know how many years, and we still can't figure out how to handle it. And the fact is that these kinds of cases are so incredibly expensive that things like motions to dismiss and things like Rule 56 and even things like sanctions are not adequate in the case where you have a design by the plaintiff's bar to bring as many cases as possible in effect to hold the defendants up for ransom. Because as I indicated to you, the modus operandi of this kind of litigation is to accumulate as many cases as possible and make it so economically unfeasible for a defendant to defend these cases, even if the defendant has a justifiable defense, that it forces some sort of settlement. The jury system is well able to handle most situations, but even in this situation, we have the Daubert situation, which tells courts that there are some issues that should not and cannot go to juries because they are not well-founded and well-scientific. We don't have the ability, when there's thousands and thousands and thousands of cases, for Daubert to step in each case and handle it. And that's why we're trying to cut this off at the beginning, Mr. Chairman.
Members, here's what I'd like to do. I have Representative Simon and Emmer on the list. And then at that point, I'd like to, and I'm sorry, De La Forest as well, at that point, I'd like to take up the amendments because my guess is much of the same discussion will occur. Representative Simon.
Thank you. A question for Mr. Price. First of all, excuse me, I have sort of a frog in my throat today. Well, you wouldn't know that, but the members might. You think I talk like this all the time. You've made some, I don't want to go too far off on a tangent, but you've made some comments today and in your prior testimony about the plaintiff's bar, as if all people who do plaintiff's work are the same. I happen to do some. I do mostly defendant's work and mostly represent defendants at another law firm near you. You surely don't mean to suggest and generalize, do you, that all attorneys who take on plaintiff's side work, like, for example, Representative Emmer and others, are behind what you're describing. Would you care to be more nuanced about your comments?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, if I may, Representative Simon. I was speaking based on my experience. I have been monitoring the scheduling litigation almost since its inception. I have attended meetings held by the Public Health Advocacy Institute, which was one of the organs that was responsible for funding the tobacco litigation over the years. I have attended speakers, listened to speakers from the Center for Science in the Public Interest. They are moving forces behind this, and I was at a meeting in September where there were 100 lawyers in Boston who were rallying for this kind of litigation. So no, I am not saying that every plaintiff's lawyer is considering this kind of litigation, but there is a significant interest in it in plaintiff's bar.
Representative Emmer?
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Emmer, Representative Simon had a
sorry, problem. Just want to follow up. You mentioned the Daubert standard, and by that I take it you mean the standard by which we judge expert testimony and expert witnesses. And as you know, under the Daubert Supreme Court decision, courts right now can and regularly do throw out junk science experts. So if I got up, and I'm by no means a scientist, and started trying to show a correlation between X and Y, and it would obviously have no basis in fact or science, that would be tossed out. A jury would never hear that. Isn't that true?
Mr. Price.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seibel. Yes, I think the problem is doing it on one-offs, one at a time. It's what we have here is when you have hundreds or hundreds of thousands of cases, if we're going to analogize this tobacco potentially, it becomes very difficult to do it one dollar decision at a time.
One last one, Representative.
Okay. On the Daubert issue, though, how is this any different than from, say, intellectual property cases, where one by one and case by case and instance by instance and lawsuit by lawsuit, judges regularly strike expert testimony that's junk science or that has no basis in fact or insufficient basis in fact, and we do that on a one-by-one basis. Can you describe how that might be any different?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, I think the difference is that usually in an IP-type case, you're dealing with one finite case or several finite cases. You're not dealing with thousands of cases. And there's a tremendous transactional cost to this. Even if you win every one of your Daubert decisions, even if every time you go into court you get the court to throw it out at some stage, even if you go to trial and win, the costs become incredibly expensive. I think I said in my testimony on Monday, in the breast implant litigation, we calculated that it cost us about $1 million to take the case through trial. And if you have 20,000 cases or 30,000 cases, you cannot afford to win all of your cases.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is, I think, mostly for Mr. Carlson, because I like Representative Erdahl's bill. I think it's very narrowly drafted to apply to a very specific situation. Mr. Carlson, the problem I have with the way, and I understand you've got a job to do, but the way you've presented it is that we're granting immunities and we're taking away the right to a jury. I don't see it in this case. In fact, our system doesn't provide a system or a claim for recovery to folks who knowingly encounter a situation who have control over their own destiny. Example is, I knowingly encounter a pool of water on the floor at the grocery store. I choose to walk through it. I fall. I break my hip. That's a open and obvious condition, and I should not have a right of a recovery. I think we refer to it in the law as primary assumption of the risk. This bill is more codifying common sense. I don't believe it's creating immunities where none exist. In fact, it's simply making clear what we already understand is the law. And it's not taking away a right to a jury, because in fact, if the law is applied as it should be, to the proper set of circumstances, then a judge, by virtue of Rule 56 or by virtue of Rule 12, must necessarily dismiss it. This law simply makes clear something we already know. And I think it's important to point out that you're not limiting consumers' rights. In fact, we're just clarifying the rights as they exist now, so we don't have the unfortunate situation that they're going through in New York, where it was dismissed once, it returned back, and I believe it's the Court of Appeals, or they call it the Supreme Court out there, took a look at it and said, you know, this thing may not have merit, but we need to allow these people to conduct some discovery. Under this law that Representative Erdahl has presented, I think it's important to note, I think my wand is broken. I think it's important, whatever you call this thing, I think it's important to note that his statute is narrowly related to food and obesity, and that it also does not protect manufacturers, sellers, anybody from a situation where they violate labeling laws, where they fail to properly disclose, or where they willfully or intentionally mislead consumers, which I think is what the law is intended. If we've got some folks out there who are intentionally trying to mislead consumers, they should answer for that. I think this law is very narrowly drafted, and I just ask you to confirm for me with that long introduction, Mr. Carlson, I mean, wouldn't you agree, there are no members of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association today that would, in fact, take a claim like this, where someone simply eats too much and puts on weight. That just isn't something that we'd see any of our competent lawyers in this state do. Wouldn't you agree?
Mr. Carl. Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, as I indicated in my opening sentence, we're not here to defend those types of claims. We don't believe they're viable, and they are not being brought in Minnesota. And so we are not here to defend those claims. What we are, and I would just mildly disagree with you, Representative Emmer, if you look at the bill on page 1, line 21, it protects food, which is not defined, and on line 23, shall not be subject to civil liability, and following on line 25, where liability arises out of weight gain. And what that says to me on its face is that if I have liability for a problem result related to weight gain, I now have, on line 23, I am not subject to civil liability. That is, to me, an immunity, and not a common sense. That's just the language of the bill as I, you know, as I read it. And I think that's the first time we've used that language to insulate a private, for-profit individuals. And I, you know, I'm certain a matter of perspective. But when you talk about the asbestos litigation being an embarrassment, and it has gone on a long time, I think part of the embarrassment is some of the conduct of companies like W.R. Grace and how they've behaved both in that litigation and with the way they've handled their knowledge about asbestos. And, you know, the single largest plaintiff's case in the country ever is against Exxon Valdez, a case handled by Mr. Price's firm. The single largest case in the country. And we don't want to foreclose the ability for people to assert their rights. That language, I'm not here to say anyone should assert a right for their own conduct in waking. I'm not saying that. Representative Kimmer.
Well, then all I would make is a comment. If that's the case, then there should be no argument about this bill, because I think the language is very clear and it has the protections that your folks should be concerned with.
Representative De La Forest, and then we'll look at amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had perhaps an expansion of Representative Emmer's question. Mr. Carlson, it's been a hypothetical for me. Under what circumstances could you foresee a fast food retailer under this bill acting in a negligent fashion?
Mr. Carlson. Mr. Chairman and Representative De La Forest, McDonald's just settled a case about a week ago, where they defrauded consumers. It wasn't a labeling requirement. It wasn't willful, but they settled a lawsuit with the American Heart Association over the amount of trans fat in their food, which they promised consumers they would remove, and they didn't. And an action was brought against them by a plaintiff in, I believe it was in California, but I'd stand to be corrected. There was an $8.5 million settlement that went to the American Heart Association. $7,500 went to the plaintiff. So to me, that is an example of something that would, that this shield may potentially be used against or used by a corporation for conduct that maybe isn't a labeling requirement, but is conduct that they have promised one thing and done another. Representative De La Forest.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. That's, so we did add an amendment, and that does say that lawsuits may proceed if there's material violation of an adulteration or misbranding requirement. I would conjecture then that if a promise was made by McDonald's regarding trans fat and they didn't do it, that they would certainly be liable, and under this bill, those types of lawsuits could go forward.
Mr. Chairman, thanks. I'll just wrap up here. It seems to me that, Mr. Carlson, this goes to the heart of the issue, and I think it's where Representative Emmer and I agree, is I'm having trouble understanding a circumstance under this bill where, at least in my view, we could hold a fast food retailer, for example, liable. I think the point of the bill is, and I don't want to speak on behalf of Representative Erdahl, he's capable of doing that himself, but I don't think, you know, the point is that you assume the risk, you are responsible for the food that you put in your mouth, and that it has nothing to do with obesity, although that is a problem. The fact is that I think the bill is narrowly drafted as well to serve the public policy that we're not going to allow these suits to go forward and clog up our courts for folks who willingly and knowingly ingest various types of food into their body that is otherwise at least safe and sanitary.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Delforce, I don't disagree with a single word you said. The problem is those cases aren't viable now. The law already says that they can't be brought because of primary assumption of risk and other legal protections for your own conduct. And so what I'm saying is that we have a solution in search of a problem, and what we really have is a huge problem with weight gain and obesity that needs a solution.
Members, I would really like to move to the amendments, or we're going to take up the rest of the whole committee meeting. I have five of them here, and I don't know if they're all going to be offered or not, but let's start with the A050102 amendment. Is anyone going to offer that? I'll let you find them first. Well, Representative Ellison.
If nobody's going to move this amendment, I'll move it.
All right. Representative Ellison moves the A050102 amendment. Representative Ellison.
Well, members, this amendment requires disclosure of what the contents of each food or beverage item would be. They'd be printed on the menu, including information like caloric number, grams of saturated and trans fat, grams of carbohydrates, milligrams of sodium per serving, and information similar like that. Essentially, you know, making the point that if you that the retailer would have to disclose what's in it, just like if you were to drink that bottle of Dr. Pepper, there's content information on it. It should be on these fast foods as well.
Representative Erdahl, you have any thoughts on this amendment?
I just oppose this amendment. I'm willing to work on it in a different form.
Representative Elton?
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, you know, here we are back at the heart of the matter again. I mean, if you can't bring these kind of lawsuits where people, right now, where people were primary subject of risk cases, the one thing that would help maybe deal with this problem of obesity is if people know what's in this stuff. And so I would just urge members to say, you know, do something for consumers. I will add this. One of the problems with, if you look at this tobacco litigation, is that until there was some discovery done, we didn't know that they were manipulating the nicotine content, even the paper in these cigarettes. We didn't know a lot of stuff until the discovery was done. All we're asking to do is on the front end, just say what's in there, and we do it all the time anyway. So I can't see how this would be a harmful or bad amendment, and I'd move it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not sure that this is exactly relevant to the amendment. The question I wanted to ask, and I believe it actually is relevant to the amendment as well as to the bill in general, and that is, does there exist in law a definition of food?
Ms. McKnight,
Mr. Chair and members, what I will do is look at Chapter 157 where this amendment is going to be coded and see if there's a definition there.
Mr. Carlson had an observation.
Ms. McKnight, you could look at Chapter 31. Which is an entire section dedicated to food. And part of my issue with it, food is defined as articles used for food or drink for humans or other animals, chewing gum, an article used for components of any such article. That's, I think, everything. I know there's an amendment that I've discussed with Representative Erdahl
that would try and restrict this to consumer commodities, and that would is further defined in that 31101 subdivision 20, and then that excludes things like tobacco, drugs, and alcoholic beverages that are not subject to labeling requirements. And we think a definition is an important part of this bill, and I don't know that Representative Erdahl and I disagree that a definition may be needed. We haven't agreed on what that definition should be.
I do note in the bill, though, despite that separate definition of food, this refers to food intended for human consumption, so I think that would probably narrow that definition already. Other discussion? Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Ellison, the way I read this, you said this is a pro-consumer amendment. Why do you only want to affect consumers who eat at chains?
Well, because...
Representative Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, consumers who buy groceries in the regular grocery store usually are already protected by labeling. So that it just covers... I don't know if that is responsive to your question exactly, but...
Like, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm more thinking about, it's a cafeteria, coffee shop, restaurant. There's a whole host of them out there that aren't necessarily part of chains. I'm just wondering if it's very pro-consumer, why you want to inform people from top to bottom, from bottom to top on Main Street, Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Well, as I read Subdivision 1, and I don't know that I, it seems to me that it would make perfect sense to look at some of these national chains that have bigger, richer, that are larger, probably have the capacity to do the labeling. I certainly wouldn't want to burden a small mainstream shop. I think that it's a balancing test at some point, Representative Broad.
Thank you.
Representative DeLaPorte.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That question, Representative Ellison, what would the cost be to implement your amendment?
Representative Ellison.
Well, I'm certain that it would be. I think it would be de minimis.
Number
5.
Representative DeLaPorte, is that acceptable to you?
I don't think I'm going to get a better answer.
Representative Westrup.
Well, Mr. Representative Ellison, I assume they'd also mark them alternatively so I could read what's in my food that I'm getting.
Representative Ellison?
Is that required in there?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure exactly the question you're asking.
Would they braille the food that I'm getting so I know what's in the food that I'm eating?
I'd be happy to entertain that as an amendment to this amendment. Would you like to make it?
Representative Westfield,
thank you. Okay. Me too.
Any other discussion on this amendment? Representative Erdahl.
Buzz Anderson of the Retailers Association is here. Perhaps he could speak to the amendment.
Mr. Anderson? If you could give us your brief thoughts on this, that would be wonderful.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Buzz Anderson. I run the Minnesota Retailers Association, where to speak in favor of the bill and to speak against the amendment. I think Representative Erdahl, what he's trying to do is bring a common sense approach to this whole issue. We've seen frivolous lawsuits pop up all over the country based on these kinds of scenarios. And I think what he's trying to do, and I'll let him speak for himself, but what we appreciate about the bill is that we think this will help to stem that tide from happening in Minnesota. I don't know of a fast food restaurant, for example, in Minnesota that doesn't already provide nutritional information, both at the store, on the website, or in request to a question by a customer. So, I don't think the amendment is necessary, and I would encourage you to vote against it and to support the bill.
All right. The motion before us is from Representative Ellison to adopt the AO5-0102 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
No. Motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted.
Division.
Division has been requested. All those in favor of the 0102 amendment, please raise your hand. And all those opposed? The motion does not prevail. All right. I'm not going to invite on each of these remaining amendments. Are there other amendments that anyone would like to offer? All right.
right, seeing no further amendments and seeing no further discussion, Representative Lash.
I haven't spoken to this yet. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to ask Representative Erdahl, well, first by way of a comment and then a question. I have some sympathy for this bill, and I think from the testimony or comments I've heard among committee members, I think most everybody does, concerns about the idea that people would come in and burden the court system in Minnesota. And I would also say, by point of information, as I look around the room, I don't know everyone really well, but I'd be willing to bet I eat McDonald's more often than the rest of you combined. I did through college, and I still do, and it tastes delicious, I have to say. But that said, in the discussion, okay, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe De La Forest eats there more. I don't know.
It was complimenting your genetics, if you can eat.
Okay, thank you. Well, I don't. You know, I get a lot of exercise on those stairs. The issue about whether or not we're going to burden Minnesota with what seems right now like frivolous lawsuits is a concern of mine, because in the recent past we've seen newspaper articles out of Minneapolis about all these kids, Northeast, in fact, Minneapolis, whose parents let them play on a pile of vermiculite in this former industrial area. And at the time, there's no question. If you'd have brought a lawsuit and say, hey, I think my kids are going to get cancer from that, it would have been frivolous because we just didn't know. Parents didn't know. That is just a junk pile. Let them play on it. We don't care. But it was the discovery that allowed us to find out that that was a hazard. Similarly, with the Ford Pinto, when you're going in to buy a Pinto, you look around, you look at where the gas tank is placed. Most people didn't, and even if you did, who cares? We didn't know what the concern was there, and all of a sudden we find out that Ford knew darn well what the problem was with that, but they didn't tell us. But it was only through discovery that we found out that was the issue. Similarly, I would have a concern right now and think that perhaps a lawsuit against a fast food giant was frivolous right now, but I don't have all the information. So my question for you, Representative Erdahl, is it seems to me that this is more of a caveat emptor, let the buyer beware kind of situation, with respect that if you eat a cheeseburger, you're going to get fat. However, would you have had the same opinion about a situation like that with vermiculite in the late 70s or the Ford Pinto?
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lesh, no, I probably wouldn't. But, you know, we learn through life here, and this is a bill about personal responsibility, and I don't know how much discovery it takes to know that if you eat too many cheeseburgers, you get fat.
Representative Slawick, and then I would like to vote on the bill so we can keep moving.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, I have a question and a comment along those lines. I mean, as one of the non-lawyers on this committee, I picture lawyers, you know, standing outside McDonald's, seeing who orders the double Whopper, I guess that would be Burger King, right? Or the Big Mac, and then talking to him afterwards. I mean, or sitting outside Weight Watcher meetings or Overeaters Anonymous, or, you know, and is that really where we're headed, and should we really be worried about this? When we had one of the members refer to it as codifying common sense, and, you know, around here we hear about common sense, mostly on the other side of the aisle. We hear about personal responsibility. I thought we didn't legislate personal responsibility. I thought that that was something that people were supposed to do with their pocketbooks, with their health care, and with their lives, and yet we have something called the Personal Responsibility and Food Consumption Act. That's what I thought people were supposed to make those choices on their own and not be legislated about their personal responsibility. Can you comment on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Slog. I don't think that this necessarily legislates personal responsibility. It just basically says that you should take personal responsibility on your own. And, you know, I'm not, you know, really concerned about our courts being flooded with this type of lawsuit. But I am concerned, and, you know, there may not, as Mr. Carlson points out, any lawsuits that are eminently on the horizon. But I do believe that, as indicated in New York, and in other places in this country, that this type of lawsuit is possible. And once one starts, the door is open. And when that happens, eventually, not just... this is not a bill to defend the fast food industry. It's, you know, distinctly designed, I think, with concerns for really the whole food chain, from the person selling at the farmer's market through the fast food company. And these types of lawsuits could go forward, and when they do, they are going to cost the people of Minnesota money, they're going to cost the consumers money, and as I pointed out a couple days ago, I think ultimately they're going to also cost our agricultural industry money.
All right. See, no further discussion. Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I request a roll call vote.
All right. A roll call has been requested. The chairman will renew his motion that House File 118, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Representative Broad.
Hi.
Representative Dean.
Yes.
Representative Ellison.
No.
Representative Emmer.
Yes.
Representative Hilke.
No.
Representative Lesh.
No.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Slawick.
No.
Representative Westrom.
Yes.
Representative De La Forest.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes. The motion prevails on a vote of 7-5.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you. The next bill on the agenda is House File 350, Representative Slawick. Representative Slavik, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 350 be moved and passed on to Ways and Means.
Ways and Means, all right. Why don't you go ahead and speak to your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Actually, Representative Broad and I both had this bill, and there must have been some discussion. I'm pleased to see that it's moving forward. This is a constitutional amendment that provides staggered terms of office for senators. It would keep senators more accountable, as half are up for election every 2 years. As you know, right now, one of the things that happens when the senators aren't up and we're up is some of the things just don't happen and don't get passed. And this would actually potentially move us along to reach agreement on issues by having them up on these staggered terms. So it would increase trust. And it would also have greater accountability to the voters. They say for the House of Representatives, we're elected every 2 years, and you all know this because it keeps us close to the voters. Virtually, we're here for a session, and then we're up for the election the next session. And with the senators, they get much farther away from it. So it would be a way of keeping them closer to the voters and also potentially preventing legislative gridlock.
Discussion on the bill. Representative Hilke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Slawick, I think that the argument you just made for it is what I would regard as an argument against it, which is, I think, sort of analogous to the reasoning that went into, at the federal level, having House of Representatives, which, as you say, is presumed to be close to the voters, and another body that serves longer terms and presumably is more removed from the voters. I think the intention of that and the reasoning behind it is precisely to ensure that the entire legislative body would not be caught up in some stampede of public opinion at the moment. Do you have a response to that?
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilke, and I was hoping my members on my side would help me think about this. And obviously, the stampede may have happened last year. Obviously, there were some huge clashes between the Senate and the House, and some. It's a lot. What happened is a lot of things broke down and didn't get done. So it does happen. And I mean, there are years where we have big social issues on the horizon that kind of block everything else. Sorry, they're calling me home. Excuse me. That was a joke. But anyhow, so that's the potential. I mean, that is the good and the bad, but I think that when we have a year like last year, at least in this legislature, that gives us food for thought and pause for thought on how to proceed, because it allows potentially one body to kind of stand in the way of things moving ahead.
Further discussion on the bill. Is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against the bill? Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just say I do support Representative Slawick, and I support the idea of having staggered Senate terms for a variety of reasons. One is to reduce partisanship. One is to make sure that we're moving the process along as it should. I don't buy the argument that the senators should be more removed. We are all supposed to have our feet held to the fire in regards to being responsive to our constituents, whether we have a 2 or 4 year term. And I think that the Senate in and of itself will continue to do that, whether their terms are staggered or not. Nobody is calling me home. The other thing is that in 1877, our Constitution actually was amended for staggered terms. And all I want to do is, I always look forward, but in this case, I want to get back to 1877, back to staggered terms. I think it's a good thing for Minnesota, and it's a good thing for our constituents.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Slavik renews her motion that House File 350 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you.
All right, the next bill on the agenda is House File 892, Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Representative De La Forest, District 49A. Mr. Chairman, I would move House File 892 for consideration and that it be held over for potential inclusion in the omnibus elections bill.
All right. Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Briefly, this bill is rather self-explanatory, so I will not go through it line by line. What it does essentially is creates a specific penalty for removing campaign materials. And I think perhaps what is more important than the language itself, as I mentioned, which is straightforward, is the policy behind the bill. And it is simply one that I and many of my colleagues in this body agree that there has been certainly an increase in what some would call pranks in terms of taking campaign materials or vandalism. And I don't view it as any kind of a prank. And I think it's important that we make a public policy statement as a body that we view those types of activities for what they are. They're a crime. Mr. Chairman and members, as you know, the very heart of our First Amendment is political speech. Democratic institutions will only prosper if those who are governed by the institutions have faith in them. And what happens when we see some of the widespread takings and vandalism and theft that we witness, it undermines people's faith in the system. And so simply my intent behind this bill is to make a public policy statement on behalf of the people of Minnesota that we don't view those types of activities as pranks. It's not a sophomore trick. What it is, it's a crime, and it deprives voters of one of the means by which they gather information in deciding for whom they will vote. Subject to that, Mr. Chairman, I would stand for any questions.
All right, Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Del Forest, I mean, I feel you on this bill. I think it's the sentiments behind it are good, but of course I'm leading up to a but, right, obviously. And the but is that, you know, let's just, you know, call the elephant in the room out, right? All right. You know, our colleague, all of our colleague, was charged with theft and pled guilty and is, you know, and dealt with for moving campaign materials. No one was proud of what that member did, and all of us kind of, you know, whatever. But the thing is that that person was held accountable for what they did, and the law worked. So I guess that's one sort of thing that I'm a little bit concerned about.
you know, an additional bill. Maybe you're thinking, well, let's just make sure with a bill. But I kind of feel like maybe the law is adequate to handle it now. Any thoughts on that subject?
Representative,
no, Representative Ellison, thank you for the question. I mean, it's obvious that there is an elephant in the living room, so to speak. And my response would be as follows, Representative Ellison. First of all, especially when you're dealing with criminal penalties, this is prospective, first of all. This has nothing to do with anything that may have occurred in the past. There's no intention to do so, and in fact, I think there'd be constitutional issues in doing so. Second, reading my bill, it applies to everybody. I mean, it applies to you, it applies to me, it applies to candidates and elected officials of all ideologies and political affiliation. So it is not intended to sort of be a statement about any one particular issue. And in fact, furthermore, I would add Representative Ellison, and I want to make sure I give credit to Representative Slawick, to you, and Representative Sandra Peterson, who is sort of at ground zero of this. They have introduced a bill of their own that is similar in virtually every substantive way to the bill I have introduced. And so I had a very nice conversation with Representative Peterson in my office one day, and I wanted to gauge sort of her sensibilities regarding the issue, because certainly it is not my intent to sort of call anybody out on this issue. And again, it would go back to the point that, as you well know, Representative Ellison, and being learned in the law, that we have many places in our law where we sort of spell out special criminal penalties for certain types of behavior. One example I can give you very quickly is that it is a crime to interfere with a firefighter or a police officer in the performance of their duties. As you know, disorderly conduct and other charges could be sufficient to charge those people in a criminal court, but we as a state have articulated a public policy that we want to say that we view that as an activity which is, you know, we're especially sensitive to. And that's sort of my rationale. I want there to be a bipartisan public statement on behalf of the state of Minnesota that we don't view this type of activity as pranks. It's serious, and this is our sort of we mean business statement.
Okay. I accept that. I just want to just share this with the committee. You know, when I ran the first time 2 years ago, there was some literature out about in my campaign that my opponent set out that was pretty mean, attacking me and the members of my family. And people in my committee didn't go up to people's houses and remove it, but they picked it up off the floor and they sort of had a big funnel of it. I don't know where they got out, have nothing to do with it. But my point is that I think that if it's campaign literature wherein the candidate is promoting their candidacy, no one should ever touch it, which is in the spirit of your bill. But I don't know how to solve the problem with this bill, but smear stuff, I think there might ought to be maybe you should be able to remove it. And that's just a sentiment I'm going to express right now. I think your bill goes to, campaign literature where you're trying to promote your candidacy for office. But if somebody's just trying to tear you down and putting out a bunch of stuff that really is not adding to the information base of the electorate, I see it a little different.
Right. And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I'm going to be supporting your bill.
Thanks. I just had Representative Ellison, you're right. The purpose of my bill sort of is the four corners of the campaign document as opposed to what might be inside. And you raised certainly a perennial issue that we won't be able to resolve today. And, you know, how far do we take free speech even within the context of the First Amendment?
Mr. Chair and Representative De La Forest, I'm not a lawyer and I should know this, but they're guilty of a misdemeanor right now. Is it a misdemeanor and then a gross misdemeanor for candidate? Is that any different than what's the difference between current law and what that is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawick, I do not practice in the criminal law area, but under Chapter 609, we do have penalties laid out for theft, and primarily, and as the Representative Lesch may be able to chime in, but as I understand it, Representative Slawick and Representative Lesch, the penalties are more or less spelled out in terms of the value of what was stolen, which I think is not appropriate here, because a piece of campaign literature may have nominal value in terms of what one might pay for it, but in my opinion certainly has great value in terms of what it says and the role it plays in facilitating the democratic process.
Was this to that point, Representative Lesch?
Sort of, yeah. I can make it part of that point.
Well, you're helping fine. Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I think this is a great bill, and it's long overdue. We really do need to bring this into law and into compliance as well. I think any references to elephants should not be construed as references to any individual or political party. I just want to put that out right away. Number two, I just had a question, and maybe this is covered elsewhere in the law, but what about destruction of campaign materials, or let's say, you know, breaking of signs and ripping up of campaign materials, or defacing or vandalism? Is that handled somewhere else in the law, or is there a reason that, or maybe should it be included here?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dean, thank you. Again, there are provisions within the criminal code which, of course, prohibit vandalism and destroying property which does not belong to you. My bill, the thought that I had in doing this bill and in consulting with others was that, you know, the problem we saw is certainly was more in the area of theft of campaign material. Certainly, this is going to be laid over. I'd be more than willing to accept any kind of amendment which would extend this bill to cover instances of vandalism as well. I have no objection to that.
Thank you. And once again, I appreciate the bill. Thank you.
Representative Black.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just note that a lot of people wonder about this. Obviously, this is a bill that was drafted in response to something that happened last campaign season. And to address some of those questions, Representative Kahn was originally charged under an ordinance and in the city of New Hope, I believe. And as some people are aware, the ordinances among cities in the state are sometimes pretty old. And even in St. Paul, most of our criminal ordinances were drafted in the late 40s or early 50s, and if you try to enforce them, they'd be either unconstitutional or just difficult to implement. So we rely on state law in a lot of these areas with respect to misdemeanor and gross misdemeanors. My question is this for you, Representative De La Forest. I know a lot of us up here at the Capitol tend to think that we as legislators or representatives are, I don't want to say this pejoratively, but a little more important in the sense that we're more focused on what we do than what the guy down the block does. The reason I'm asking is this. If I was a business owner and I wanted to pass out flyers for windshields to get your windshield redone and my competitor was going along and taking those off, the same thing wouldn't apply to him. And I think this is important. I am going to support the bill, but my question for you is, what makes us as legislators in our activities in campaigning more important than an individual who also wants to get his flyers out?
Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lesh, good question. The philosophy I have with respect to your question is similar to what the Supreme Court of the U.S. has articulated, in that there are different forms of speech. As you know, there's a different standard for business speech than political speech. And so consistent with the public policy behind my bill, I recognize that political speech, that the literature we put out is political speech and deserving of a higher standard, in the same way that courts have recognized that political speech is a different animal than, say, the business speech you referenced in your hypothetical. And it's for that reason that this bill addresses specifically political speech.
One follow-up, and I apologize if I missed part of this answer then. I wasn't here a little bit earlier. So why is it then that it's worse in terms of a gross misdemeanor, philosophically, for a candidate to do it rather than another individual to do it?
Representative
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, it is simply a recognition that candidates and elected officials should know better.
Thank you.
Representative Simon.
Actually, this sort of dovetails off of Representative Lesh's comment. I applaud that part of your bill. I think you're right. I think we ought to hold ourselves to a higher standard. My question is just whether or not, and maybe this is a question for Representative Slawik, really, but is there a difference there between your bill and the Slawik-Peterson bill? Do they both hold we as elected officials or candidates to that higher standard?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Simon, you're correct. Substantively, the standards are the same between the two bills.
Any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, Representative De La Forest renews his motion that this bill be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We are continuing House File 1007, so that is the last item on our agenda. We are adjourned.